Avery Broderick, who cannot be here for extremely understandable reasons. So it will be a slightly different experience, but I give it my all. I'd like to talk about not only images of supermassive black holes, which you've all seen by now, but also about mapping of space-time, which I think this particular audience is perhaps more interested in than beautiful pictures. I'm coming from the University of Southern Denmark, which has been the first Danish addition in terms of institutes to the EHT, and we're currently trying to get a bit more involvement going over there. So let's see. Can I change slides? I think I can. There we go. So what's coming? I give you a very quick tour about this VLBI business and how the EHT functions. I'll be very quick here. This is not going to be much news to you. What it takes to make such images, and a little bit about the past, the present, and the future, which I think is also important. After all, we're talking about some very tricky constraints and very ambitious attempts at measuring something that's pretty hidden from us. So I think looking into the future is always a very desirable approach there. What do the instruments bring in the near future? A very important point I want to make is that the image really isn't everything. It is hardly anything, I believe, for what most of you are trying to do. The image is just one of many representative models that are representing the data that we measure. The data we measure are not an image. It's not a CCD camera, and in fact contain much more information. And depending on what the predictions are that your favorite theory is making, you definitely gain a lot by making your model predictions as close as possible to where the measurement happens, which is in the Fourier domain of the image. Then, of course, the big question, why do we think it's a black hole? What are we looking at? How about Einstein's GR versus non-GR theories and some difficulties that you're all very familiar with? Like Astrid also mentioned, I want to emphasize the importance of bringing theory as close as possible to observations, and also to not close your eyes when it comes to the astrophysics. One of the things that we had to learn the hard way, I guess, in the EHT over the last, 3 to maybe 5 years, depending on how you count, is that the astrophysics tends to bite back when you try to ignore it. It is there, we have to deal with it, and it doesn't matter if you're just interested in finding out something about gravity. If your model doesn't capture that or mitigates the effects of the astrophysics that are present, you're going to have biases and all kinds of problems on the data analysis front. So probing gravity is difficult, even with these exquisite instruments and even with the best analysis tools that we've been come up with. And in the second half of my talk, I'll be going back to M87, actually, and show you what I think is a very promising way to say something about space-time in presence of confounding effects from space-time. So here we got the M87 picture, observed in 2017, like Sagittarius A star, but published in April 2019. And took us a lot longer, 3 years longer, to come up with this picture. And I wanted to give you at least some excuses for that, why it took us so long. There has been very innovative times. And one of these innovations that came between M87 and Sagittarius A star is that we now have a new way of doing the imaging. So this is a new all Bayesian imaging approach. We're reconstructing images with the ability to come up with an error bar. So if you ask the other previous imaging teams, you point your finger at a particular pixel that you're interested in the image, and you ask them, what is your uncertainty there? What's the error bar on that pixel? They cannot really tell you, and here you can. So these are the images we reconstruct, and with every measurement over here comes an entire space of posterior distributions. So we can ask for every pixel, what is the error in the pixel flux? We can analyze what is the correlation of that error with another pixel somewhere else in the picture, and all kinds of things. And as you can see, let me go flip back. There are some differences. This is averaged over all methods that we've been using. Many people ask about these three blobs. They're not very significant for multiple reasons. We, in fact, decided that our way to go was to combine the data from April 6 and 7, unlike the other imaging methods, because we clearly saw that April 6 contained an intrinsic variability that took us quite a while to hunt down. And your resulting image is always going to be an average over multiple instances. The source is changing very rapidly, and how the image exactly looks like will depend on which data you combine. There are, of course, some morphological things that don't change within a certain error bar, like the ring diameter. That's one we care about, and so on. This is an area where we see tremendous amounts. Sorry. Sorry for the online people. That may have been a little bit loud. With the 2029 data and 2018 data, we hope to make some improvements there. We need to make images faster with the instrument, and one way to do that is to add more telescopes to the array. So what does it take to make that image? First of all, you want to choose, of course, light that has a wavelength that actually reveals the immediate surroundings of the black hole, just like the difference between you going through the airport security scanners. They're using pretty similar wavelengths, actually, millimeter, to check whether you're carrying anything around your body. It's because millimeter waves tend to reflect very strongly water molecules on the surface. But if you have a broken bone, let's say, and you go to the doctor, you wouldn't use radio waves, right? You would go to the x-rays. So very much here, you need to pick wavelengths that allow you to see the light that you care about. That puts us into the millimeter wavelength regime. And it's a fortunate coincidence that at that wavelength, the lambda over d that we get from our optics is allowing us to achieve these resolutions of 40 microarc seconds, assuming that we can build a telescope the size of Earth, which is not very easy, of course. And so we combine instead distant telescopes and observe them, keeping track of the arrival times of the photons and synthesizing effectively a telescope that has the size of the planet, with a lot of holes in it, obviously. And there's other things, not just the resolution. I'll talk about some things about sensitivity, telescope coverage. All of that can be just as important as the ability to resolve something on the sky. And it's also about algorithms, not just instruments and theory. So this is the highest angular resolution image ever obtained, despite all the questions of why does it look so fuzzy. It's an enormously small angle. The way I remember it is to imagine if you have two golf balls on the moon, try to look at it from the surface of Earth, distinguishing the left edge from the right edge here. That's roughly the angle we're talking about. And this video is just saying that there are two golf balls on the moon. So it's not a bad analogy at all. So how does the technique work? Very roughly speaking, the radio waves are coming in, excellent approximation to say that they are plain parallel waves. By the time they reach Earth, they will hit the telescopes at slightly different times. Light is fast, but not that fast. So we need atomic clock standards here to keep track of that. We record the data with that timestamp on board. It's an enormous amount of data. We're talking about petabytes for the 2017 observations. And we record them. It's the only way we can do it. And that enormous data volume cannot be transferred over the internet, especially not from remote locations like the South Pole or a Greenland telescope, which joined the array in 2018. So we fly them literally with planes to the supercomputer, where we do the correlation. Only here, months later, after the observation, do you have a chance of actually checking whether everything worked out. Slightly terrifying. Then some calibration exercises happen. And as you can see, while we're going through this sequence, the data volume is dramatically reduced. And the final image that gets reconstructed is only, what, a couple of kilobytes. You can download it from the web and check how big the file is. So it's an enormous reduction in data. You could say that most of what we measure is actually just noise. You know, you don't put that in the proposal, but it's true. So it's 12 orders or so of magnitude in data reduction. It's the only way we can do it. If we could do a live correlation, that would be much easier. So a word on interferometry. Many people are familiar and focus on the resolution capabilities, but it's just as important to have a good distribution of telescopes. You want the high image fidelity and reconstruct the image in all sorts of ways, not just resolve something that you see on the sky. This is something that my bachelor student put together that I find quite illustrative. Here's a famous radio source. And here he just went through the exercise of just leaving out the long baseline, so cutting the high resolution end of the array. And you can see you get a picture that looks like this. You know, it's missing some of the fine filaments. That is intuitively pretty straightforward. But what happens if you leave out The short baselines, the large resolution, that's a little bit tough for our intuition to make sense of. And you get a picture that only gets the small structure right, but completely misses, like on the large scale, how the image looks like. And to our intuition, the large scale effects of that image are more important when we try as a human to judge how similar these images look like. So it's a little bit tricky. You want not just the resolution, you also want many telescopes that probe a variety of different scales. Thankfully, our whole planet is rotating. So that means that if we look at, in this case, M87, different telescopes are seeing the source at a different time. And as the Earth is continuing to rotate, it will probe different Fourier modes of the image. That's what you're seeing here at the beginning of the observing night, hardly any data. The image is poorly constrained. And as we're filling the bucket with more and more data points, then the image algorithms are more and more capable of keying in on the actual structure. And there's very much algorithmic work involved, as much as improvements to the instrument itself. Here are a few slides on the telescopes that are involved, all very remote locations, very challenging conditions. And the Greenland telescope, which is not shown here, joined in 2018, and we're working hard at that data set. So expect some publications to come pretty soon. And we're really speeding up as a collaboration. There's been a lot of innovations, and now we can do things a lot more quickly. What's the plan for the future? So if you write your papers on non-GR predictions, what are the resolutions you can quote and the capabilities and all that stuff, the most exciting story, I think, is that already with the data we have, but haven't gotten to finishing the analysis of, in 2021, we have three more telescopes compared to 2017. Three doesn't sound like a lot, but three compared to eight is a dramatic improvement. And the number of detections we get goes as the number of stations squared. So it's going to be quite a nice data set. By a couple of years forward, we're talking about 10 new stations as part of the NGEHT, NSF-funded design study at the moment. First light probably 2032, I think. 10 new stations, that's massive. That's a game changer in all sorts of ways. There are some clear progress, concrete progress, to move from 230 gigahertz, one millimeter wavelength, to 0.7 millimeter, 345 gigahertz capabilities, maybe even higher if things go well. There are sensitivity enhancements on the way, for example, by a multi-frequency phase transfer that allows us to integrate the light longer than the turbulence timescale in the atmosphere, because we can use the phase information from lower frequency. So that could dramatically improve our signal-to-noise ratios, and so on. Other improvements along the way. We're currently trying from the Danish side to find funding to move the Greenland telescope to the summit of Greenland. Currently, it's at sea level at the U.S. Air Base in Thule. If that were to move to the Greenland summit at 3 kilometers height, it makes the telescope much, much better. Much better weather over there. Then there's, of course, space VLBI, even more challenging for multiple reasons, but it might be further down the road, 2030 plus, an extremely interesting endeavor where you can reach completely different kinds of angular resolutions, of course. And the bottom line for you is that you can expect an improvement in angular resolution, direct angular resolution of 50%, just from the move to 345 gigahertz alone. Better coverage, hopefully better data quality. There's always improvements on all sorts of systematics as we go forward. And also, the ability to make faster images will be absolutely key for Sagittarius A star, which is changing on a very short timescale. And our ability to monitor these sources, not just once a year, hopefully. At some point, we want to do this without ALMA and operate maybe on a multiple-month timescale or something. Right, so Sagittarius A star was, this is the excuse slide, was much harder than M87, because one of the things that the standard textbooks on VLBI tell you is that you can only pull off this Earth aperture synthesis, where you use the rotation of the Earth, when the source isn't changing in time. Right? And so we had to reinvent how to do VLBI, because Sagittarius A star is not changing on 7 hours timescales, like M87, mg over c cubed, right? But it's more like 20 seconds. So when we take an image over a night, the source has changed multiple times. And that's what I'm referring to when you ask about detailed morphological effects in that average image. It depends very greatly on the timescale that you've used to create that average image. At some point, of course, if the average is taken over long enough periods, you'd expect a more or less unique picture. Right. So so that needed a lot of innovation, and I'm going to briefly mention to you how we did this. But if you don't do anything about this this process, you are in trouble. Now, here's an example. So this is one of many GR-Image D simulations that we've been producing in the collaboration. It's been turned into a synchrotron emission map by the usual radiative transfer, ray tracing techniques. So this is how it would look like if you had a perfect telescope and that theoretical model was a perfect description of nature. So that's a lot of ifs, but okay. Let's take that for granted. Then if you look at the data, how the EHT would see it, you would get something like this. And you see as the movie is playing, this is synchronized, you can see that the measurements are not only changing very clearly and obviously, but they change much more than the statistical error bars, the thermal error bars of the instrument is capable of addressing. So if you don't do anything to address this variability, and you try, let's say, to infer the ring diameter from these models, you get from your analysis a posterior distribution that could fail to hit the ground truth, which thankfully you know in this case, right? But real observations are a little bit more tricky than that.
So what's the difference between the blue region and the orange region then?
So okay, let's see. What do we got here? This is. I'm trying to remember what the exact analysis was. That's a good question. Different time scales, I believe.
Is that related to the red on the left graph?
It could be that we're here using only two data points. I doubt it, but I actually forgot the details. But I think it's. It's some reduction of data volume. I fail to remember whether it's a reduction in this domain, just taking out some baselines, or whether it's due to using 1 day versus 2 days. But I can look that up.
Is there an obvious reason why it's biased low as opposed to high?
It could be both directions. It just depends on where the emission structure is around the region you care about. So it could be biased in both directions. Some biases tend to have a preference, like, for example, it depends also how you measure the ring diameter, the various techniques of doing that once you have an image. And there are some measurements that are biased because, for example, if you plunk down circles on a ring, you get more area outside the circle just because at larger radii, you just get less of an overlap, you know, and that can bias you outwards. But yeah, there's many biases in these analyses. Hence, so important to think about this very carefully and use a variety of different models and not just one and then say this is it. The data is variable not just from our expectations, and that is a result that gets easily overlooked. We measure this, right? So even if we had no theoretical reason to believe that it was variable, we see that very clearly. So on April 6th, the red data points, this is just one baseline. Which one is it? Chile LMT. We say Chile because we have ALMA and we have APEX at Chile. And you can see that here, for example, the difference at about, you know, 1 GMST is much larger than the error bars of the instrument. So the data is very clearly variable. And that's for the first time that we're seeing on horizon scales a variability of a couple of minutes, let's say. And that in itself is, I think, a big part of the story, that we're really seeing some very compact, fast-moving stuff in the vicinity of a black hole.
Is that a minute? I cannot read that.
Well, this is in hours, but from the analysis where we did more than this, I can say that it's on the order of a few minutes, the 5 to 10 minutes that we see evidence for variability. We have very precise inferences actually for the variability too, which is an interesting probe of GR-MHD turbulence, right? It's not just about space-time, but I left the astrophysics out of the talk as much as I could. right, so on to the elephant in the room. What is it that we're looking at in both of these cases? Of course, one of the things you can say is that everything's consistent so far with the idea that this is a black hole, as GR is explaining it. That is, some people say that's a conservative interpretation. You could also say it's an ignorant approach, right? After all, black holes, or GR for that matter, have issues, right? Just think of the singularities, you know this better than me. So the clear emphasis here is that we need to do much more work, right? This is just one line of investigation, very much the opposite of let's build a model for how this could look like in a different theory of gravity. You could also say, let's assume that GR is correct and see how far we can get with that assumption and with the data we've measured. Both can be improved, right, and be made more realistic. Can we find a crack in GR? And that hopefully would then provide a guide of some kind where to look. So that's the hope. And unfortunately, astrophysics gets in the way. This is for M87. We went through all these different possibilities of some possibilities, how gas can fall into the black hole, parameterizing the hell out of everything, and came out of this with a lot of model images. And that determines a huge component of our error bar, which is really theoretical in nature. The angular measurement, the angular size measurement we make is actually quite precise. But how that translates into the thing we care about, which is, you know, the photon ring or the low order photon ring and the mass of the space-time or the spin potentially, that is where a large degree of theoretical uncertainty is coming in. Together with yes.
I just wanted to ask, when you mentioned the Bayesian approach where you get the error bars, that includes the sample variance over all these different models?
In a certain way. So that is the degree of innovation that I can say something more about in like one slide or two. I'm going to mention a little bit more that I think addresses the question. If it doesn't, let me know. I can expand on that. Together with Dom Pesci, I led paper 4 of this Sagittarius A star series, and we were focusing on the intrinsic variability, the morphology, and in particular how these two are related. And the inference of the black hole mass under the assumption that GR is correct. And one of the things that we did to address the intrinsic variability, you can have fundamentally two different approaches. You can either do what we call a snapshot approach. Let me start here. In the snapshot approach, we decided to only take data on timescales where we think it is fair to assume that the source is stationary. That means minutes at most. Used model fitting approaches and averaged them in a statistical sense to come up with an angular diameter measurement. So that was one way. The other approach, which we term full track, is where you do what we normally do in VLBI analysis, take the whole observing night, but then you have to deal with the intrinsic variability and the effects it generates. And we modeled that as an enhanced, carefully designed, but enhanced error budget. What did we assume? We looked at the whole body of GRMHD simulations. Yes, they're not perfect. Nevertheless, they give us a very reasonable idea of the astrophysics that can happen. And we looked at the how the variance in these simulations is affecting the Fourier domain measurement that we're making. And you get a variance that looks like this as a function of UV distance, which is always the thing that pops up in our VLBI analysis. You see a point at pretty large angular scales where this noise dominates, and then it peters off. It's almost a broken power law. So the GRMHD models are not just giving us a hint for what the model looks like, how the emission structure looks like. It gives us also a model of the noise, or a measurement, if you like, on the variability characteristics. So it's these two approaches that are entirely new that allowed us to make a VLBI analysis of something like Sagittarius A star to begin with. Without these innovations, you couldn't have produced an image. It's as simple as that.
So just to understand this, so the points are your measurements, and then the regions are the range of simulation.
Exactly. Okay. So and they actually, like, the measurements are really beginning to stress test the theoretical models. You can read more on that in paper 5 of the series, but some of them are still consistent. Yes?
Sorry if I missed this. Why is this more statistically significant between baselines 2.5 to 6? Because you're saying the noise is decreasing, so why is it more statistically significant?
Oh, over here? Yeah. That's pretty much that you have a torus of a characteristic size, and most of that power comes, probably it's related to the rotation, the differential rotation, where the pressure maximum is like moving around. It's just, this is where the fluctuations in the emission tend to be strongest. And there's some variance in the across the models, of course, where that is. But that's the main reason why. Yes?
In your GRMHD, you insert the Kern metric.
Yes.
So, in a way, it's a null hypothesis. So, if you wanted to modify gravity theory, mine, for example, you have to put that model in.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
This takes more computer power.
Definitely, yes, it does. One of the differences between paper 4 and paper 6, which both estimate the mass of the black hole, was precisely that in paper 4 we took the approach of assuming explicitly that GR is correct. In paper 6 we somewhat relaxed that assumption, but then of course, as you point out, these simulations are expensive, not just because of this theory, there are other theories, right? So and then what do you do? So we included other models parameterizing some deviations of GR, but then these were just single images, right? They were not simulations that were on the same footing as these, so they don't take into account the variability in the same way. So at the moment, we're left in this pickle, if you like, that we cannot get both perfectly described. Ideally, you would have a GRMHD type simulation for all possible theories of gravity, which is not realistic. So. Yes.
H2 is a star mm-hmm. orbiting.
Yeah.
And that determines from Newtonian gravity acceleration the mass quite accurately.
Yes, let me flip to that.
Also, the periodic shift is
measured. Yes, exactly. So that's a much more exquisite measurement that you can see here in the green or red line between the Keck observatory and the VLT observatory. They don't agree, actually, right? They agree to disagree for quite a long time, but both of these measurements are more accurate than the inferences we can make with the event horizon telescope. So this is the mass, if you like, or the angular diameter measured. And you can see for the different methods that we've been using, I'm not going into detail, that our posterior distribution of that angular size is much wider than what you get from observing stars around that black hole. It has multiple reasons, but the best way to improve the width of these distributions is to get a better handle on the unknown inclination of the Sagittarius A star source, because that determines how many GRMHD simulations we have to consider in our calibration suite. So that's one of the reasons. Yes, so it's nice to have that independent measurement in Sagittarius A star. That makes it very attractive for gravity tests, because you can have an EHT plus stellar dynamics kind of approach. The same approach, there's a similar measurement in M87, but not directly resolved. But M87 is good for another reason, which I will get into. Let me go back real quick. The morphology, we obviously are interested in whether we see a ring at all on the sky, and we try to be as little biased by our human perception as possible. So what we do is we run different analysis schemes that make different assumptions about the emission structure, and then try to quantify, again in different ways, whether there is a ring in the image, and if so, what is its diameter. And you can see here that it depends on what you're doing, you get slightly different answers, and it's only this varied approach that allows us to get a good handle on our uncertainty in this important quantity. So just to sum it up, we do recover a ring diameter that is actually very well measured, right? This is about 4% accuracy, 51.8 plus or minus 2.3 microarc seconds. It is when you try to convert that into a mass measurement, this is where you inherit all the uncertainty. But this ring diameter measurement is actually quite precise. We even get a ring thickness constraint that was different than M87, so we're slightly surprised by that. Other things like anything else, basically, the magnitude or the orientation of the asymmetry in your brightness distribution, or, and this is important, the central brightness depression, like how dark it is in the interior, is very, very poorly constrained, which is very, yes?
How do you define the ring diameter when you come up with that number?
That is part of the reason why different methods to get there are slightly varying in
the methods to measure. I don't even know the definition of
it is part of the measurement, right? So if you want to quantify what is the ring diameter, you have to say, how do I measure the ring, right? What is the ring I'm using to make the measurement? And then how do you compare the data to that model to come up with an answer? So you could, for example, say, I model it as an infinitely sharp ring that I then blur to the resolution that the EHT is using. That is one way. You could also make an image first with a VRBI imaging reconstruction, and then fitting that to a filter that is a ring. That doesn't give you the same answer, right? Because then you have generated the image before that introduces a different error budget, and then you're filtering that down to a ring. So that introduces a bias, for example. But you could also start with a model like a crescent that subtracts two circles. That's also a ring-like structure, but it's a different ring structure than an infinitely sharp delta ring. And depending on what you're doing, you will get slightly different answers, even for the same data set. And so that is part of the uncertainty, not the biggest part.
Why does it make sense to quote a diameter at 5% accuracy when the definition of the ring itself that you're even using probably has much greater ambiguity?
The definition of the ring would not be introducing a deviation of this magnitude. What introduces a much bigger uncertainty is how you translate it to what you care about. Like when you move to a mass, then the error bars are much bigger than this. But on the level of characterizing the ring size, it's introducing a relatively minor bias. Significant,
so
but...
one more time, because I really didn't follow your answer. So what is the definition of the ring?
So I guess we agree what an infinitely sharp ring is, right? So that's a delta ring.
No, I don't know. If you have the idea that there is a general relativistic black hole with a certain mass and spin behind this, then it has a definite photon ring. And you could be asking, we're going to do our best to measure it for that black hole, but we don't know the mass and spin, so we're also going to try to measure them. And then in the end, but I don't think that's what you're doing. I think you have a kind of geometrical definition.
We do both.
An observational definition of the ring.
Okay.
But then I don't see what the definition is.
So the first part of your question doesn't actually get into, I think, whether it is a black hole that we're seeing or whether it's a GRMHD simulation that we should look at. It just characterizes that you're seeing a geometric shape on the sky, right? And so that's what I meant with the infinitely sharp ring, where you just have to fit, basically, it's a geometric model fitting exercise. Like, if I assume this is an infinitely sharp ring that gets blurred to the 20 microarc seconds that I know is the resolution limit of my instrument, then that is a straightforward model exercise. And then the answer is the ring is just like, well, a circle, basically, right? A geometric circle. The second part of your question is, of course, much more complicated. If you're assuming that this is caused by a black hole, and this is caused by photons that move around the black hole, and then you inherit a much larger degree of uncertainty, because how this emission structure maps onto the space-time properties, like the photon ring or the low-order photon rings, is subject to your lack of understanding how the emission structure is tied to spin and mass and so on. And that is the heart of the second part, which I hope I can get into.
Carla has a very good question.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding your second bullet point, because, or maybe I'm a theoretician who doesn't understand astrophysics. Are you saying that observationally you find a lower sort of estimation of bound for the thickness?
Yeah. So in M87 we were not able to constrain how thick or how thin the ring really was. It was very, very marginal.
You were or were not?
We were not, really. The data wasn't...
Are the data compatible with a very thin ring?
Compatible, but it could have been a much stronger inference. Here, this is still a poor constraint, right?
Excluding.
We're not excluding. I mean, there's no surprises about the expectation from GR, but it's a statement, I think, about data quality, right? So... To get a sense of how sharp the ring is, in other words, to just make it sharper, how sharp the ring really is, GR predicted to be much sharper, of course, and then we're very much limited by the instrument. Yeah, exactly. So we have to push the boundaries much more. Yes?
So you said the bottleneck in the, on the posterior was the inclination of the source.
Yeah.
Is there any way to constrain that? Like, I assume the stellar dynamics doesn't do this very well either.
There was in particular one paper by the Gravity Collaboration where they believe they saw some kind of a flare, like a hotspot, that they got very close to Sagittarius A star. And within that model assumption, which might well be the way forward, they were able to make a pretty sharp constraint on the inclination. So if something happens in the source, or we keep monitoring and keep observing, at some point, the data should, in principle, narrow this down more and more. Both from our VLBI view, well, it's both a VLBI instrument, but from the EHT view and the UCLA or Keck groups. So I think the answer is, yeah, we're going to get a handle on it. And there are multiple ways of doing it, but at the moment, there is some uncertainty. In particular, we did not expect to see that kind of face-on like image. Is it face-on? I don't know. It looks more face-on than we thought it might. Before reconstructing the images. Okay, I'm going to press on. So I'm going to skip that, but just so we all understand that once you convert to the gravitational quantity that we're all interested in, the error bars get much bigger, right? So if you get the angular diameter measurement or the mass, which you can get by using a measurement of the distance to the source, you measure Maser distances and you get an error bar that's on the order of 25%. So that's very uncertain. All right, so second part is going to M87 and showing you one possible avenue forward with an EHT-only kind of approach where you're not relying on independent measurements. And that's really about a sequence of papers led by Avery, starting with a method that not only does the VLBI imaging, but that does the imaging together with a model fitting approach, and that allows you to make a joint fit of a ring component, the thin ring component, plus the usual imaging components. A second paper that talks about if you have measured the direct emission, as we call it, the one that is weakly affected by lensing, and a ring that's formed by photons that has gone around halfway around the black hole, what can you do with these two measurements? In particular when you can monitor the source. And then the third paper is applying this method to M87, the 2017 data. And this is really a distinct kind of approach. So in the first, let's try to extract the ring first. So you're doing a model where you say, all right, there is potentially a narrow ring in the image. It has to be narrow. It could have zero flux if the fitting scheme decides to do that. There's a wide prior on that. And you add on top the usual imaging that we're doing in VLBI. And then you can ask questions of, do you get fits that are statistically preferred over the pure imaging results that you saw previously or not? The answer is we do get statistically preferred fits on three of the 4 days. And then you get a detection. That's my little one crying, wonderful. No stress involved.
FBI soundtrack.
Exactly. there you go. So here you have not only the ring diameter measurements tightened up, but we also found evidence for a jet structure. I'm skipping this because it's astrophysics. Then you get a full posterior on the ring size for the 2017 campaign. And we get evidence for evolution in the source. We estimated ring size biases because even this method isn't perfect. We're not seeing the N infinity type photon ring that we all know from our GR textbooks. So there is a slight bias introduced. It's not the real like N infinity photon ring. And the second one is really just an illustration, a way to how do we make sense of these measurements, emphasizing that it's a lensing measurement that we're making. 5 minutes. Okay, I'll try to speed up. And the lensing character is if you measure two size scales in your image, one is very sharp, coming from this N=1 photon ring. The other one is the diffuse emission, as we call it. What can you make just purely on that? And it turns out you can actually make space-time measurements this way. So let me skip this. Just a method that we're going about this. It's important to have a separation of scales between the ring component and the VLBI imaging, because then the different model components are not competing in describing the same image structure. And that allows us to pull out the thin ring that is way below the resolution capabilities of our instrument. So here's an example, GRMHD simulation turned into a synchrotron emission map, just one example. We've tested it with many others. And the technique is pulling out this thin ring right here. There is a posterior distribution that comes with it. The blue is the flux distribution profile from the simulation itself. Here we're zooming in, and the green posterior is the inferred ring diameter. So in many of these cases, it is working extremely well. And it depends on the details, you know, and you have to check how the UV coverage and so on is affecting things. Here we've applied it to the 4 days of measurements of M87. And we've blurred now the model to the resolution limit of the telescope, which is why these images don't look so strikingly different from what we've published. And you can see it produces very reasonable looking images that are in agreement with previous results. But the additional assumption that we're putting in, want to be clear, this is an assumption. If there is a sharp ring in there, we can pull out its size. And then we can ask, is that size, under that assumption, consistent with being caused by a photon ring? The photon ring is related to the mass. So it's not going to change from one day to the other, or from 1 week to the other, not even over a year's time scale. So that is a test. It is a strong test of the method. And the posterior distributions we found are very much in agreement with what a n equals 1 photon ring can do. So the posterior is moving around a little bit, around the 22 microarc second level or so, but it is perfectly statistically consistent that it can move around by this little. So you get a signature that that allows you to make a much sharper mass inference compared to the previous EHT analysis, under the assumption that GR is correct, that the ring that you're seeing is actually sharp. If you're willing to make that assumption, you can ask the data under that assumption, what are you able to tell me? And you get a much sharper prediction for the ring diameter, and it is withstanding that test. So our hypothesis that what we're seeing is, at least in part, caused by the n equals 1 photon ring is consistent with our measurements. And of course, there is a bias. So if you have an emission somewhere near the black hole, it will depend on where exactly that emission comes from, and it will depend on what space-time you had, how this gets mapped into rings on a distant camera position. And you can use that fact and basically turn it around. Sorry. And ask, okay, if I plot the diffuse emission, the angular radius of the diffuse emission, versus the n equals 1 photon ring, you will get different curves that depend on the space-time and depend on where the emission was coming from. And you can make mappings of space-time this way. Now, of course, we did this in various different assumptions. Sometimes we assume the emission to be caused just on the equatorial plane, just caused by individual sharp thin rings, which is not necessarily the truth. And sometimes, let me skip here, this is a bit clearer, but we've actually shown that a radial distribution of the emission profile is not really changing the effectiveness of the method. I wanted to get to this. So if you have an emission region, which you don't know in a real observation, you don't know where the photons really came from, and you plot it as a function of spin in your model, then you get different trajectories. And you can see here that the diffuse emission, the one that is hardly affected by the gravitational lensing, is not giving you any handle, basically, on the space-time properties. But that the n equals 1 or even n equals 2 emission, if you could measure it, provide much stronger possibilities to do this measurement. I'm almost done. But you can use that and come up with these curves. Let me use that as an example. Map it onto a mass spin plane. If you have an emission region of two, let's say one gravitational radius, very close to the horizon, you can get this kind of curve. It's a degenerate measurement. But if you can measure it a second time, you can come up with, if you're lucky, the emission happens at much larger radii, the curve is changing. But clearly, both of these curves have to be explained by the same spin and the same mass. This hasn't changed, right, from one observation campaign to the next. And you can use that to nail down the space-time properties. This is not reality at the moment, but this is one possible avenue. Make some assumptions about how accurate you can pull this off. And if things are really going well, you could end up with a posterior in that space just using a VLBI measurement, no stellar dynamics involved. You just have to push the capabilities of the instrument. So I think that is a promising route. And the 2018 data that we're about to tackle right now is the first opportunity at making a spin measurement, right? Previously with the 2017, you can only make a mass measurement. With a second one, you can measure spin. And with a third, well, I guess then we can get into tests of gravity. This is one example. It's not the best example in the world, but if you take a Kerr-Newman black hole just as an illustrative example, how would these plots look like? Well, in that case, these three curves that you now need would not intersect in the same point. And that's how a signature of non-Kerr would look like in this analysis. Anyway, so there's a test similar to what Pulsar people are doing with their plots and making a null hypothesis test of GR. Yeah, I think I'll stop here. Sorry for running over, but
thanks.
We did extract it, yes. In what are you measuring with the signal, though? So it is. We can infer how much variability noise, if you want to call it, is required to make the data consistent, and that provides you with a measurement of how much turbulence there had to be in the simulation for our measurements to be correct. So we're inferring the time variability of the source that was going on, and also the angular scale, by the way. On what that occurs, you know. So it's not just an amount of variability; it's also on what scale was it variable. Both of these are there's a companion official paper about the intrinsic variability and all that, where we get into this. It's an interesting, mostly astrophysical application, but it's really nice. So we make a measurement, we infer how variable the data is. That's right. Yeah, it's like a CMB power. Series, right? And yeah.
Okay, good.
But time dependent.
The last question, John?
Yes, to what extent do your results for the photon ring size and shadow size depend on the accretion disk, accretion flow?
That's a very important element of trying to extract the n equals one photon ring, because it reduces the dependence enormously on the surrounding emission. If you're not able to make the identification of the n equals one photon ring, and you rely on the entire image, then the constraints are very poor, because the angular size and how it's related to the mass is actually not even bounded. So if you had an infinitely extended emission distribution, you would have no idea what the mass is. Now we know that we don't see anything from a parsec away because our instrument can't pick it up. The moment you are able to identify that about 10 or 15% or whatever in that image is caused by the n equals one photon ring, then all of a sudden you can convince yourself that there is an upper bound, because in order for the photons to go around a half turn around the black hole, they had to have come from a pretty narrow region in the spacetime. And it's that ingredient that really pins down that relationship. There's still some uncertainty, right? Measuring N2 would be better than N1, but it's very small uncertainty. The error bar improvement was like a factor of 6, I believe, relative to the original, more agnostic EHT analysis.
So you're making an assumption about the accretion?
We're making an assumption about what is causing the emission in the image. That's the assumption we're making. Yeah.
So on that note, let's thank Roman again.